searched the man's gear and found a medical blowout bag on Barnes's hip. He sat down on the grass and did his best to treat his wound in the dark. He assumed he had a long walk to reach the border and wanted to patch his injured leg so it could stand the trek. It was a clean wound, in and out, no major vascular or orthopedic damage, nothing much to worry about if you treated it early and well and did not mind days or weeks of throbbing discomfort. Gentry puked bile once more, his body and his mind just catching up to the chaos of the past 5 minutes. Then he stood and slowly began walking north, towards Turkey. Chapter 7. Fitzroy sat across from Lloyd on the couch in his office. Even as the older man listened to the other end of the satellite connection, his angry eyes did not flicker away from the young lawyer.
"I see," said Fitzroy into the phone. "Thank you."
He terminated the call and placed the phone gently on the table in front of him. Lloyd stared back, hopeful. Fitzroy broke the staring contest with a gaze to the carpet.
"It seems they're all dead."
"Who's dead?" asked Lloyd, the tint of optimism ever growing in his voice.
"Everyone but the flight crew. I am told there was a bit of a dust-up in the aircraft. Cortland did not go down easily. No surprise there. The pilot found two of my men's bodies in the back, no sign of the other four. Blood on the floor, walls, and ceiling, over 50 bullet holes in the fuselage."
"My firm will compensate you for the damages," Lloyd said it matter-of-factly. He cleared his throat. "But they did not find Gentry's body? Could he have survived?"
"It appears not. There was a lot of gear lost. The plane flew for miles with its rear cargo door open, and among the unaccounted for items is a parachute. But there's no reason to assume—"
Lloyd interrupted. "If our target is missing out the rear of an airplane along with a parachute, I can hardly convince the Nigerians the job is done."
"He was outnumbered 5-1 against a Tier 1 crew, all ex-Canadian Special Forces. Clearly, I have fulfilled my end of our bargain. I ask you to now kindly carry out yours. Stop your threats to my family."
Lloyd waved a dismissive hand in the air. "Ebu Bakr wants proof. He demanded Gentry's head in an ice chest."
"Damn it, man," said Fitzroy. "I did as I was told."
Fitzroy was angry, but he was no longer fearful for his son's family. Shortly before Lloyd arrived, Sir Donald had called his son, had him collect his wife and children, and rush to St. Pancras Station in time to make the morning's second Eurostar train to France. At this very moment, they should be settling into the family's summer villa just south of the Normandy beaches. Fitzroy felt confident Lloyd's men would not find them there.
"Yes, you did as you were told, and you will continue to do so. I have a very quiet but very ominous Nigerian back in my office who will not leave with my assurances only. I will need for you to ascertain the flight path of the pilots, and I'll need to send a team to investigate—"
The phone on Fitzroy's desk chirped with a distinctive ring of two short bleats. Sir Donald spun his head to it, and then back up to Lloyd.
"It's him," said Lloyd, responding to Fitzroy's obvious shock.
"That's his ring."
"Then answer it and activate the speaker function."
Fitzroy crossed the room and pressed a button on the console on his desk.
"Cheltenham Security?"
The voice that came through the line was distant. The words came out between labored breaths.
"You call that a rescue?"
"It's good to hear your voice. What happened?"
Lloyd quickly pulled a notebook from his briefcase.
"I was going to ask you the same thing."
"Are you hurt?"
"I'll live. No thanks to the extraction squad you sent to pick me up."
Fitzroy looked to Lloyd. The young American scribbled something on his notepad and held it up. "Nigeria."
"Son, I heard from the flight crew about the melee. These were not regular employees of mine, just a mercenary unit I had used once before. I was rushed to get a team together after the Polish pulled out.
Because of what happened in Iraq?
Yes. That whole sector has become a no-go zone after your little demonstration yesterday. The Polish refused to go in. The men I sent instead let me know they'd do anything for money, despite the risks. Clearly, someone got to them, bought them off.
Who?
My sources tell me Julius Abubakar, the Nigerian president, is after your head.
How does he know I was the one who waxed his brother?
Your reputation, no doubt. You have reached the status where some jobs are so difficult or high profile that they just have to be you.
Shit, said the voice through the line.
Fitzroy asked,
Where are you? I'll send another team to pick you up.
Hell no, you won't.
Look, Court, I can help you. Abubakar leaves office in a few days. He will leave with unimaginable wealth, but his power and his reach will be lessened once he is a civilian. The danger to you will soon pass. Let me bring you in. Watch over you until then.
I can lie low on my own. Call me when you get more intel on the men after me. Don't try to find me. You won't.
And with that, the connection died. Lloyd clapped.
Well played, Sir Donald. Quite a performance. Your man didn't suspect you at all.
He trusts me,
Fitzroy said angrily.
For 4 years, he's had every reason in the world to think I was his friend.
The American lawyer ignored Sir Donald's anger and asked, Where will he go? Sir Donald sat back on the couch and ran his hands over his bald head. He looked up quickly.
A double! You want a head in an ice chest? I will bloody well get you a head in an ice chest. How the hell will Abubakar know the difference?
Lloyd just shook his head.
Weeks ago, before the president demanded we kill him, he asked us for all the intelligence we had on the Gray Man. I happened to have photos, dental records, a complete history, etc. I sent that to him, thinking the son of a bitch would just kill Gentry himself before the hit on his brother was carried out. Abubakar knows your man's face. We can't use a body double, or, as you suggest, a head double.
Fitzroy cocked his head slowly.
How the bloody hell did you come by this information?
Lloyd regarded the question for a long moment. He picked at a piece of lint on the knee of his pants.
Before I moved to Paris to join Laurent, the Gray Man and I worked together.
Your CIA?
X. Definitely X. There's no money in patriotism, I'm afraid.
And there is money in hunting down patriots? Threatening to hurt children?
Good money, as it happens. The world is a funny place. I copied personnel files when I was with the agency. I planned to use them as a bargaining chip if they ever came after me. It's just serendipity that these documents have proven useful in my current position.
Lloyd stood and began pacing Fitzroy's office.
I need to know where Gentry is now, where he's going, what he normally does when he goes into hiding.
When he goes into hiding, he simply vanishes. You can kiss your natural gas goodbye. The Gray Man will not turn up on anyone's radar again for months.
Unacceptable. I need you to give me something, something about Gentry I don't already know. When he worked for us, he was a machine. No friends, no family that he gave a damn about. No lover stuck away for those long nights after a job. His SAD file is about the most boring read imaginable. No vices, no weakness. He's older now. Surely he's made associates of a personal nature, developed tendencies that will help us figure out his next step. I'm sure you can tell me something, no matter how trivial, that I can use to flush him out.
Fitzroy smiled a little. He sensed the desperation in his young adversary. He said,
Nothing. Nothing at all. We communicate via untraceable sat phone and email. If he has a home or a girl or a family hidden away, I wouldn't know where to tell you to look.
Lloyd walked over to the window behind Fitzroy's desk. The Englishman remained on the sofa and watched the uninvited guest pace the office as if Fitzroy himself were the visitor and Lloyd was the proprietor of Cheltenham Services. Suddenly, the American spun around.
You can offer him a job. An easy job for big money. Surely he won't turn down a high-paying milk run. You send him on a new mission, and I'll have a team there to ambush him.
Bloody hell, you think he survived out there this long by being a fool? He has no interest in earning wages at the moment. He's busy blending into his surroundings. You had one shot to take him out, and you made a mess of it. Go back to your office and lick your wounds. Leave me and my family alone.
Fitzroy noticed a nervous twitch in Lloyd's face. It was replaced slowly by a smile.
Well, if you won't help me use Gentry's weakness to flush him out, I will be forced to use yours.
He pulled his phone from his pocket and smiled at Don Fitzroy as he spoke into it.
Pick up Philip Fitzroy and family. They're at their summer cottage in Normandy. Take them to Chateau Laurent.
Fitzroy rose to his feet.
You bloody wanker!
Guilty as charged.
Lloyd's tone mocked the Englishman. My associates will hold your son and his family at a secluded property Laurent Group owns in Normandy. They will be well taken care of until this matter is resolved. You will contact the Grey Man and give him their location. Tell him the Nigerians are holding your only child, his adoring wife, and their darling little kitties there. Tell him those black savages promised to rape dear mommy and slaughter the rest of the clan in 3 days, unless you give up your assassin's location.
What good will that do?
I know, Gentry. He is loyal like a fucking puppy. Even though he's been kicked around a few times, he will defend his master to the death.
He won't.
He will. He'll take it upon himself to save the day. He'll understand the police are useless, and he will move heaven and earth to get to France. You see, Sir Donnie, Court Gentry's compass never has pointed true north. He's a hitman, for God's sake. But all his operations, both with the CIA as well as in his private practice, have been against those he deems worthy of extrajudicial execution. Terrorists, mafia dons, drug dealers, all manner of nefarious ne'er-do-wells. Court is a killer, but he thinks himself to be a righter of wrongs, an instrument of justice. This is his flaw, and this flaw will be his downfall.
Fitzroy knew the same about Court Gentry. Lloyd's logic was sound. Still, the older man tried to appeal to the young solicitor.
You needn't involve my family. I will do as you say. I've already shown you that. You don't have to hold them for me to tell Gentry they are held.
Lloyd waved a hand in the air, striking down Sir Donald's offer.
We will take good care of them. If you try to trick me, some sort of double cross, then I will need leverage against you, won't I?
Fitzroy stood and crossed the room towards Lloyd, slowly and with menace. Although he was easily 30 years older than the American lawyer, the former MI5 man possessed a larger frame. Lloyd took a step back and called out,
Mr. Leary and Mr. O'Neill, would you step in, please?
Fitzroy had given his secretary the day off. He was all alone in his workplace. But Lloyd had brought associates. Two athletic-looking men entered the office and stood by the door. One was red-headed and fair-skinned, on the downside of 40, with a simple business suit that bulged at the hip with the impression of a gun's butt. The second man was older, near 50, with salt-and-pepper hair cut in a military high and tight, and his jacket hung loose enough on his body to hold an arsenal tucked away from view inside. Fitzroy knew muscle goons when he saw them.
Lloyd said, Irish Republicans, your old enemies, though I shouldn't think we'll give them too much to do. You and I will be seeing a lot of each other in the next few days. There is no reason our relationship should be anything less than cordial.
Claire Fitzroy had just turned 8 years old the previous summer.
It was the end of November now, and she and her twin sister Kate had expected to stay in London throughout the wet, gray, and chilling autumn without a break from the routine. Up each weekday morning early for the walk to her primary school on North Audrey Street, out of class and into thrice-weekly piano practice for Claire and vocal lessons for Kate. Weekends spent with Mummy in the shops or Daddy at home or on the football pitch. Each fortnight, one of the girls would have a friend over for a slumber party and, as the dreary London skies of fall morphed into the drier but drearier skies of winter, all Claire's dreams would turn to Christmas. Christmas was always spent in France at her father's holiday cottage in Bayeux, just across the channel in Normandy. Claire preferred Normandy to London, fancied a future for herself on a farm. So it had been a great moment of surprise and adventure when the headmaster of her school stepped into the girls' class Thursday morning, just after roll, to call Claire and Kate out and back to the office.
"Bring your school books, ladies, please." "Lovely. Sorry for the intrusion, Mrs. Wheeling. Do carry on."
Father was in the office, and he took each girl by the hand and led them out to a waiting taxi. Daddy had a Jaguar, and Mummy drove a Saab, so the girls could not imagine where they were going in a taxicab. Mummy sat in the vast back seat, and she, like Daddy, was serious and distant.
"Girls, we're off on a little holiday. Down to Normandy, taking the Eurostar. No, of course nothing's wrong, don't be daft."
On the train, the girls barely sat in their seats. Mummy and Daddy stayed huddled together, talking, leaving Claire and Kate to run amok up and down the car. Claire heard Daddy ring Grandpa Don on his mobile. He began speaking quietly but angrily, a voice she had never heard him use with Grandpa Don. She stopped following her sister as they attempted to hop down the complete length of the car on one leg. She looked to her father, his worried face, the biting tone of his voice, words impossible to hear but impossible to interpret as anything other than anger. Daddy snapped the phone shut and spoke to Mummy. The only time young Claire had ever seen her daddy so visibly upset was when he yelled at a worker fixing the sink in their townhouse after he'd said something to Mummy that made her face turn red as a strawberry. Claire began to cry, but she did not let it show. Claire and her family left the Eurostar in Lille and took another train west to Normandy. By noon, they were in their cottage. Kate helped Mum in the kitchen wash fresh corn for dinner. Claire sat on her bed upstairs and looked out to the drive below, to her father. He marched up and down the gravel, speaking into his mobile. Occasionally, he rested a hand on the picket fence along the garden. Her father's anger and consternation twisted her tiny insides into knots. Her sister was downstairs, unaware and unworried, but Claire considered Kate the less mature of the 2 8-year-old twins. Finally, Daddy put his phone in his pocket, shivered against the chill in the air, and turned to walk back up the drive. He'd not gotten more than a few steps when two brown cars pulled in behind him. He turned back to the cars as men began pouring out. Claire counted 6 in all, big men, leather jackets of different colors and styles. The first man to Daddy smiled and stuck out a hand, and Daddy shook it. The other men filed around her father, up the drive and towards the cottage. Daddy looked to the men as they passed, and for an instant, Claire saw his expression. It was first confusion, and then it was terror. And young Claire leapt to her feet in her little room. And when the 6 men, all as one, reached into their coats and drew big black and silver guns, 8-year-old Claire Fitzroy screamed.
Chapter 8. Kurt Riegel was 52 years old and as tall, blonde, and broad as his Germanic name implied. He had joined Laurent Group just out of the German Bundeswehr 17 years prior, worked his way up from associate director of security in the Hamburg branch office, through a half dozen third world foreign postings, each dingier and more dangerous than the last,
and now he sat firmly ensconced in the Paris Home Office as Vice President of Security Risk Management Operations. It was a long title, a fancy heading, that belied a simple explanation of his job. Regal was the man one called if one needed something bad to happen. Off-the-books projects, black arts, human resource problems that required a visit from the heavies, black bag, sneak-and-peek burglary squads, corporate espionage teams, media disinformation experts, even hitmen. When Regal's agents came to your office, it either meant they were there to help you clean up a difficult problem, or you yourself were the difficult problem someone had sent them to clean up. Leading the Department of Malicious Measures virtually assured Regal would climb no higher up the corporate ladder. No one wanted the chief headknocker out in the daylight running the show. But Regal did not mind the glass ceiling above him.